from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, Los Angeles and Southern California, generally, whence this broadcast originates most of the time, has long been known as a community where people who drive for hours every day, it's really second nature driving here, driving a car, that is to say. You know that. But it's been known for years, at least to those who live here, that the skill of the average driver just takes a precipitous tumble as soon as the first drop of rain falls on any given day. It's just people get totally flummoxed by the presence of rain and think either, gee, I got to drive faster now, or, gee, I got to drive really slow now, as opposed to, gee, I got to drive the way I normally do, but just a little bit more carefully. That would be the third option, you see. Anyway, I'm proud to announce, as a result of my empirical research today, that we've now added fog to the conditions in which people forget how to drive, like humans. Man, two of them in 5 minutes. Driving like, well, you know, if you want to disprove the whole evolutionary thing of man coming from monkeys, don't look at the way people drive in L.A. when it's foggy. As of now, I would say, because monkeys probably couldn't do that much worse. Other things that make me proud of this community, from the Los Angeles dog trainer, which always makes me proud. After months of hand-wringing and doomsday forecasts about the erosion of the movie-going audience, four straight weekends of crowded theaters have forced studio executives to admit in public what they have spent months avoiding. They were clueless about what audiences wanted. This makes the newspaper, ladies and gentlemen, that studio executives are clueless. It's the big story right here in the paper. Quote, there's always a year when the pundits say the movie business is over, said producer Brian Grazer, whose May release Cinderella Man was a disappointment, at least to him. Quote, if there's a movie people want to see, they go see it. I just think we all have to do our best to make better movies, unquote. I am so proud to live in a community where it only takes 17,000 flops to teach somebody that. Not that he's had 17,000, you know what I'm saying. Let's make better movies. How about that? How about that for a T-shirt? Yeah, it would sell a whole lot here. Make better movies, babe. And final reason to be proud of Southern California on this auspicious weekend, ladies and gentlemen. O.J. Simpson and his former teammate Al Cowlings are making public appearances at the Necro Comic-Con. Is he talking English? Yes, he is. Strange kind of English, but still English. At Northridge, site of the last big earthquake. Any significance there? I don't think so. Simpson is signing autographs and posing for pictures for fee starting at $95 per signature. How come Fred Goldman doesn't get any of that money? It's in California. What's the deal? The story doesn't seem to indicate that. Any reason as to why Fred Goldman wouldn't be getting, because O.J. still owes him $33 million for, you know, killing his son. This is the 10th anniversary of Simpson's acquittal in his criminal trial, though he was, of course, found liable in his civil trial, don't you know? When asked why Simpson chose now to make this appearance, co-promoter Thomas Riccio stated, why not now? See, you answer a question with a question. It works every time. The Necro Comic-Con, Necro, N-E-C-R-O. See, no matter how you pronounce it, it reminds you of the deceased. The show features a spooky house, well, design. The show features a spooky house, haunted theme park, live bands, because the dead bands wanted more money, I guess. Simpson is there right now, I guess, in Northridge. And he stated, in addition to giving autographs, since he's in the San Fernando Valley, he will spend some of his time looking for the real arsonist. Hello, welcome to the show.
just made up. The madman just made up his mind. He had fought all his life, but he wasn't fighting anymore. Turned the pain into his sight, but he could not see.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the show. And now, I'll read the trades for you. From Advertising Age, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita of the advertising world, Advertising Week Parade goes awry. What? How can that happen? I'll read it for you. What I'll do. Dateline New York. Billed as advertising's own Broadway showstopper, a procession of ad icons that was to work its way through Times Square and up Madison Avenue was put to a stop by the New York Police Department due to concerns about stopping traffic. The procession that was to kick off the second annual Advertising Week was more of a sprint than a parade. Event organizers hoped to create a visual spectacle in the heart of New York's outdoor ad spectacle. It's their reuse of the word, not mine. That would wow the throngs of tourists, business people, and passers-by about advertising's impact and benefits. And simply spread around good cheer. But the Budweiser Clydesdales, slated for months to lead the procession, didn't show up. Nixed, said event organizers, by the police department. Instead, Birch, Drake, president of Advertising Week, and a number of ad characters from the Geico Gecko to the Doublemint Twins grabbed seats and convertibles and sped through Times Square so fast they left members of street teams hired to hand out goodies to parade watchers in the dust. then to 437 Madison Avenue, headquarters of an ad agency, to announce the names of the five finalists in the Best Icon and Best Slogan competitions, as well as the creation of an advertising icon museum set to open late 2007 in Kansas City, Missouri. The five icon finalists are the Doublemint Twins, the Energizer Bunny, the Geico Gecko, Juan Valdez, and the Budweiser Clydesdales. I'd go to Kansas City to see any of them. Wouldn't you? The five slogan finalists are, just do it, when you care enough to send the very best, we deliver for you, what happens here stays here, and imagination at work. Also present at the event was Conchita, Juan Valdez's mule, and her handler. Reasons you want to be in New York? Yeah. So you can see that. Except, that, doesn't every parade get to stop traffic in New York? That's what occurs to me as a quizzical comeback when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, ladies and gentlemen, following up on a story not heard here but heard elsewhere in the broadcast firmament, the National Arbor Day Foundation is set to honor Walmart for transplanting trees that were in the way of building a superstore in Florida. The Award of Excellence salutes Walmart for moving the trees from a five-acre wetland destroyed by the store and its parking lot. That was what was aired on many commercial radio stations around the country by a distinguished network newsman. But records show that many of the transplanted trees ended up dying. Walmart says 25 of the 1,400 trees died, a 98% success rate. But reports Walmart filed with the Southwest Florida Water Management District found at least 83 dead trees. So many transplants died in one area. The agency recommended Walmart replace them with new trees. We don't know if those died. But they got the award, see? That's what counts. Ladies and gentlemen, let's check out the digital wonderland for a moment. Australia's full switch to digital television may be delayed now until 2011 due to the fact that consumers aren't rushing to buy digital televisions. Sound like any place you recognize? If it's so darn good, why aren't we embracing it more? Digital and analog broadcasting was scheduled to cease at the end of 2008. But the Federal Minister for Communication says the 2008 deadline now seems unachievable. Same thing we heard in this country about the original deadline, which was this year. But now, Dateline Washington, according to Broadcasting and Cable magazine, calling first responder communications problems during 9/11 and Katrina a Tower of Babel. Former Deputy Director of Homeland Security Asa Hutchinson this week called on Congress to move up the date for switching off analog television in this country to early 2008 from the anticipated 2009. Excuse me. In his commentary in the Washington Times, however, Hutchinson also said the problem of emergency communication was not primarily one of bandwidth. See, the point here is when they turn off the analog signals on TV, some of those channels would be given to first responders, supposedly. The others would be auctioned off for a big windfall for the federal budget. But now, Hutchinson says, bandwidth isn't the problem. Instead, the problem is, quote, inadequate radios and other devices, unquote. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has suggested that so-called smart radios, the kind that turn off car talk, you mean? Smart radios, which seek out unused frequencies, might help with that problem. David Donovan, so now they're trying to use Hurricane Katrina to turn off your analog TV, ladies and gentlemen, to just get you into the digital wonder. Once you get in there, you're going to be busting your buttons. Let's face it. Indian security agencies, this is in India, have been alarmed by reports that, do you know about Google Earth, ladies and gentlemen? I'm just going to back up and explain this for a moment. Google Earth is this new deal where you can get pretty good satellite pictures from Google for free. A lot of people were taking advantage of it during Katrina, and you can kind of zoom in pretty close. Now, Indian security agencies, I go back to this, alarmed by reports that the United States has prevailed upon Google to blur out locations it considers vulnerable, the United States considers vulnerable, including the White House, the Pentagon, and President Bush's ranch at Crawford, Texas. The pictures can still be accessed and have been readily copied by surfers to other locations on the Internet. So, but anyway, Indian officials say that if that request has been made, then the same yardstick should apply to India's parliament, the Indian president's house, and the place where the prime minister resides. They're under a strict no-fly zone and are equally at risk. The issue of satellite imagery has been discussed at the highest level, says a Indian official, but the government has concluded that technology cannot be stopped. Our security agencies are aware of these photos, but how can we stop technology? Question mark. The feeling among security officials in India is that the precision levels of the photographs available so far are not good enough yet to orchestrate or plan an attack. So get back to us next year. We have so much about the aftermath of Katrina today, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get into it. Across the hurricane-ravaged Gulf Coast, thousands of blue tarps are being nailed to wind-damaged roofs. Government assistance in action. The blue sheeting is rapidly becoming the largest roofing project in the nation's history. According to Knight Ridder newspapers, it is not coming cheap. Knight Ridder has found that a lack of oversight, generous contracting deals, and poor planning mean that government agencies are shelling out as much as 10 times what the temporary fix would normally cost. The government is paying contractors an average of $2,400 for less than 2 hours of work to cover each damaged roof and giving them endless supplies of blue sheeting for free. As many as 300,000 homes in Louisiana alone may need roof repairs. The amount the government is paying to nail down blue tarps, designed to last 3 months, raises major questions about how little taxpayers may be getting for their money as contractors line up at the government trough for billions of dollars in repair and reconstruction contracts. That wouldn't be rife with corruption, would it? Steve Manser, president of a roofing corporation in Youngstown, Ohio, which was awarded an initial $10 million contract to begin Operation Blue Roof in New Orleans, acknowledges the price his company is charging to install blue tarps could pay for shingling an entire roof. He defends his contract, saying it would be impossible to install permanent roofs quickly because of the need. The rapid response required contractors to mobilize hundreds of crews, truck supplies halfway across the country, and house and feed armies of workers. No, Halliburton isn't involved. Jim Pogue, a spokesman for the Army Corps of Engineers, will be hearing more about them in the weeks to come, since there's major questioning now of the construction of the flood wall that breached at the 17th Street Canal in New Orleans. He says this agency strictly followed government contracting requirements and did all it could to get the best deal possible for the roofing work. He also said FEMA asked the Corps to manage the roofing program, not something the Corps would usually do, because FEMA's resources are spread thin. Contractors watching from the sidelines, however, said they'd be happy to do the work for a fraction of what the government is paying. One of the mysteries of the response to Katrina has been why the military, which was standing by, and federal disaster agencies, which had pre-positioned supplies in the area, didn't move in more quickly. Senior government officials have told the Wall Street Journal one major reason for the delay was they believed they had to plan for a far more complicated military operation, not a straight-ahead relief effort. Accounts from local officials of widespread looting and unspeakable violence, accounts which this week have been revealed to be essentially fallacious, raised the specter at the time that soldiers might be forced to confront or even kill American citizens. That prospect added political and tactical complications to the job of filling the city with troops and set back relief efforts by days. The misinformation says the Journal raises the question of why the federal government had so much trouble gathering its own intelligence that could have provided a more accurate picture. Do we need Porter Goss? I don't think so. More, when the definitive story of the Katrina disaster is told, one long and tragic comic chapter will be the Odyssey of the Ice. 91,000 tons of ice cubes intended to cool food, medicine, and sweltering victims of the storm cost taxpayers more than $100 million. Most of it was never delivered. I don't know if you saw Mike Brown doing a heck of a job in his testimony this week saying, ice wasn't a big priority. You know, what do you need ice for? To cool my Diet Coke? Cool your hamburger meat? Those were the two examples he gave. Keeping old people alive and keeping, among other things, diabetes medication cool weren't on his list. There's a trucker, Mark Kostanek, who was dropping a load of beef in Canton, Ohio, when his dispatcher called with an urgent government job. Pick up 20 tons of ice in Greenville, Pennsylvania. Take it to Carthage, Missouri, a staging area for FEMA. Instead of unloading at Carthage, he was told to take his 2,000 bags of ice to Montgomery, Alabama. After a day and a half in Montgomery, he was sent to Camp Shelby in Mississippi. From there, he was waved onward to Selma, Alabama, and after 2 days in Selma, he was redirected to Emporia, Virginia, along with scores of other frustrated drivers who had been given similar runarounds at Emporia. He sat for an entire week, his trailer burning fuel around the clock, hello, Saudi Arabia, to keep the ice frozen. As FEMA officials studied whether supplies originally purchased for Katrina might be used for Hurricane Ophelia, hurricane that never happened. In the end, only three of about 150 ice trucks were sent to North Carolina, where Ophelia might have made landfall. So on September 17th, he headed to Fremont, Nebraska, where he unloaded his ice into a government-rented storage freezer the next day. I dragged that ice around for 4,100 miles, he says, and it never got used. They didn't seem to know how much ice they were buying and how much they were using. The money was good, but we were upset about not being able to help. Partly because of the massive evacuation, but partly because of what an inspector general now calls a broken system for tracking goods at FEMA. The agency ordered far more ice than could be distributed to the people who needed it. And, of course, those people didn't get the ice. Oh, there's more. The FEMA website doesn't work except when you use Internet Explorer, and even when you do that, it lets you through an automated test to distinguish humans from robots, but then it says security access and control unavailable. Your request cannot be processed because the system is unavailable. Please try again later or contact the FEMA helpline. So it only works under one browser, and it doesn't work at that browser. And in case you thought Mike Brown was an oddity, an anomaly, the Bush administration is being assailed, according to Los Angeles dog trainer, for nominating another political ally to head a key agency responding to foreign disasters. Ellen Sauerbrey has been appointed to the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migrations, despite a total lack of experience in emergency response work. However, she is a former member of the Republican National Committee and the Bush State Campaign Chairwoman in 2000. If confirmed, she would head an agency with a $700 million annual budget that has responsibility for coordinating the U.S. government's response to refugee crisis during natural disasters and wars. But hey, those are foreigners. Everything's cool.
Land of the beautiful queen. Gone back home to my baby. Going back to New Orleans. On the step, here come the Neville brothers.
Sing that man, my proud rat, who's
what will I wrong? Gonna get my fill of that A2 face, cause New Orleans is my home. Is that a jumbo jet? No, that's Big Al coming to put a hood on you. Fish, jambalaya, red beans, and fine praline. Get some love and that gon' satisfy home in New Orleans.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, you may be aware of a controversy involving Bill Bennett, big, portly. If you ever had the privilege, I ask this as a basically rhetorical question, because I know the answer is probably no, to eat next to Bill Bennett. Now, look, you know I like New Orleans. I like lusty eaters, but this is ridiculous. I did. I sat at a table next to him when I was in Boston last year at the Democratic convention. Falstaffian doesn't begin to describe it. But, you know, he lectures the rest of us on impulse control and virtue. Anyway, here's his version of it. Well, I'll give you his version, and then I'll let you hear it yourself. And you be the judge, ladies and gentlemen. From the desk of William J. Bennett. Quote, on Wednesday, a caller to my radio show proposed the idea that one good argument for the pro-life position would be that if we didn't have abortions, Social Security would be solvent. I stated my doubts about such a thesis, as well as my opposition to such a form of argument. I then stated that such extrapolations of this argument can cut both ways, and cited the current bestseller, Freakonomics, which discusses the author's thesis that abortion reduces crime. Then, putting my philosophy professor's hat on, I guess he just had it blocked, I went on to reveal the limitations of such arguments by showing the absurdity in another such argument along the same lines. In so doing, I suggested a hypothetical analogy, while at the same time saying the proposition I was using about blacks and abortion was, quote, impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible, unquote. A thought experiment about public policy on national radio should not have received the condemnations it has. Unquote, Bill Bennett. That's part of his statement. And read it all only have an hour. Now, here's what he actually said on the air.
You know, one of the arguments in this book, Freakonomics, that they make is that the declining crime rate, you know, this they deal with this hypothesis, that one of the reasons crime is down is that abortion is up. Well,
I don't think that statistic is accurate.
Well, I don't think it is either. I don't think it is either because, first of all, I think there's just too much that you don't know. But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do, but your crime rate would go down. So these far-reaching, you know, extensive extrapolations are, I think, tricky.
I do know that it's true, he said on the air. In his statement, he said, I suggested a hypothetical analogy. Okay, all right. You be the judge, as I say, whether I do know that it's true, that if you want to reduce crime, you abort all black babies, is the same as suggesting a hypothetical analogy. I'm going to take off my philosophy professor's hat now because it's binding. It's tight around the edges. What do we have here? We have some news, ladies and gentlemen, from where would it be? It would be from outside the bubble. For the first time, American soldiers who personally tortured Iraqi prisoners have come forward to give testimony to human rights organizations about the crimes they committed. Three soldiers, a captain and two sergeants from the 82nd Airborne, stationed near Fallujah, have told Human Rights Watch how prisoners were tortured as a way of breaking them for interrogation sessions and as a form of stress relief. The 82nd Airborne soldiers at Forward Operating Base Mercury earned the nickname the Murderous Maniacs from local Iraqis and took the moniker as a badge of honor. This is from the Glasgow Sunday Herald. These soldiers referred to their Iraqi captives as PUCs, persons under control, and used the expressions effing a puck and smoking a puck to refer respectively to torture and forced physical exertion. One sergeant provided graphic descriptions about acts of abuse carried out both by himself and others. He now says he regrets his actions. He said, the first interrogation I observed was the first time I saw a puck pushed to the brink of a stroke or heart attack. At first I was surprised, like, this is what we're allowed to do? It was a game. It was like a game, said the sergeant. You know, how far can you make this guy go before he passes out or just collapses on you? To F a puck means to beat him up. We would give them blows to the head, chest, legs, and stomach, pull them down, kick dirt on them. This happened every day. Some days we would just get so bored, we would have everyone sit in a corner and then make them get in a pyramid. We did that for amusement. Sleep deprivation was also a really big thing, the sergeant added. To prepare a prisoner for interrogation, officers ordered that the Iraqis be deprived of sleep by banging on their cages, crashing them into the cages, kicking them, kicking dirt, and yelling. They'd also pour cold water over prisoners and then cover them in sand and mud. Many prisoners were completely innocent and had no part in the insurgency, he said. But intelligence officers had told soldiers to exhaust the prisoners to make them cooperate. He said he now knew the behavior was wrong, but added, this was the norm. Trends were accepted. Leadership failed to provide clear guidance, so we just developed it. As long as no puck came up dead, it happened. More about Iraq. What's going to be the impact of the new Iraqi constitution? From the New York Times, officials say that if the constitution is defeated, insurgents will most likely believe they have won a significant victory and be encouraged to fight on. Conversely, it is said, the insurgency will grow stronger if the voters approve the Constitution, because that will anger Sunnis who opposed it and empower Sunni insurgents who can claim that their views were ignored. So, either way. Says General Abizaid, head of Central Command, quote, Iraq is going to be a pretty difficult security environment for a while, unquote. Hey, count me in. Britain's top soldier says the Army's morale and its ability to attract new recruits has been suffering because people see the British Armed Forces as, quote, guilty by association, unquote, with Tony Blair's decision to go to war in Iraq. This is according to the Rupert Murdoch-owned Sunday Times. General Sir Michael Walker also conceded that Britain and the United States would have to settle for a less than perfect result from the invasion of Iraq. Less than perfect. Typical British understatement, I guess. The invasion, how about this for less typical American overstatement? Or, Deadline Washington, the invasion of Iraq was the greatest strategic disaster in United States history. This according to a retired U.S. Army general. Retired Army General Lieutenant General William Odom, a Vietnam veteran, said the invasion of Iraq alienated America's Middle East allies, making it harder to prosecute the war against terrorists. The U.S. should withdraw from Iraq, he said, and reposition its military forces along the Afghan-Pakistani border to capture Osama bin Laden. Did we do that? I thought we did that. Iraq's proposed constitution, more about that, and the process used to draft it have deepened the divide among Iraq's factions and will likely trigger a civil war, according to a report by the International Crisis Group. Unless the flaws of its draft constitution can be corrected in the next few weeks before the Iraqi people vote on it, Iraq is likely to slide toward full-scale civil war and the breakup of the country. Yeah, that sounds less than perfect. I'd buy that description. You already know the number of Iraqi army battalions that can fight insurgents without U.S. and coalition help has dropped from 3 to 1. That from top U.S. generals at Congress this week. They added that the security situation is too uncertain to predict large-scale American troop withdrawals, anytime soon. As for the oil industry, was supposed to pay for all this. The failure to rebuild key components of Iraq's petroleum industry has impeded oil production and may have permanently damaged the largest of the country's vast oil fields. This in the L.A. Dog Trainer from American and Iraqi experts. The deficiencies have deprived Iraq of hundreds of millions of dollars in potential revenue and kept millions of barrels of oil off the world market. Aside from that, no real negative consequences. Engineering mistakes, poor leadership, and shifting priorities have delayed or led to the cancellation of several projects critical to restoring Iraq's oil industry. The troubles have been compounded by security issues, poor maintenance, and disputes between the United States and its main contractor, Kellogg Brown and Root, a division of Halliburton, ladies and gentlemen. Questions raised over whether the guy that was slain this week, described by President Bush as the second most wanted al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, was as significant as claimed. This is about the third or fourth number two guy, Abu Azam, this was. But, you know, there's got to be a new number two. They can at least, you know, do that well. After cutting off U.S. access to a key military base, Uzbekistan, wave them bye-bye, has already also quietly terminated cooperation with the war on terror. The president of Islam Karimov, one of the most authoritarian former Soviet area leaders, has made a strategic decision to move away from the agreement made with President Bush after 9/11. It's cooling relations with Europe as well. This follows tough criticism from Washington and Europe over Uzbekistan's crackdown on protests, where human rights groups say hundreds died. Uzbekistan claims they were terrorists, blah, blah, blah. All right, to Washington, and you know what's going on there. The indictment of Tom DeLay, Senator Bill Frist, under some investigation for his selling of stock. Basically the same thing that put Martha Stewart in prison. But, you know, there's not going to be a new version of The Accomplice starring Bill Frist. And he doesn't have a line of sheets. There are also other problems maybe looming. Judith Miller's testimony on Friday may mean the investigation into the Valerie Plame leak is coming to an end. Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, who is the chief of staff for Vice President Cheney, both now have been fingered as sources for the outing of the CIA operative, even though the Bush administration once said nobody in the White House had anything to do with it. And, you know, and then there's this war, and then there's this Katrina deal. Although the president does seem to be recovering the polls a little bit in the wake of his frequent visits to Texas and Louisiana after Hurricane Rita. Phone call happening, you think?
Wounded Eagle. Gee, 43, sounds like even the Secret Service is seeing a certain downward dip in your fortunes. Hey, 41, no such thing. Yeah. See, all the passwords are randomly selected by a computer. They take over FEMA's mainframe every couple of weeks for an hour or two and generate the next run. Well, anyway, Sprout, been a while. Lot on your plate. Lot on my plate.
Yeah.
Hey, 41, I feel like it's how that fell in. What was that cartoon show? The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where they just keep adding brooms.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah.
So, how are you holding up?
Well, for one thing, I haven't made this many trips to some place in Texas that's not my ranch since my days with the Rangers.
Yeah.
Back then, you know, you knew you had a close to even chance it might be a winning day, but we're making good progress in the poll numbers. See, it's hard work, but we're working hard to show that we care.
Mm-hmm. See, this is why Barr wanted me to call you.
Oh, how is she?
She wanted me to call you, is how she is.
Yeah, that bad.
See, now that you've designed your whole presidency around correcting what your crowd thinks of as my mistakes.
You know, 41, this is like a deja vu experience here, you know.
Yeah.
You always calling me up to say how you not going after Saddam or not holding the line on taxes wasn't a mistake, and whatever I did to correct the course was. And, you know, at some point, I'm just going to let Andy Card take your calls.
Not like that this time. Wanted to remind you of one time when your father really did step in some deep doo-doo campaign appearance.
Yeah.
Some 3x5 cards at the podium.
Yeah.
One got into the hands of the media. What did it say on it?
Yeah, message I care. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was some deep dish poop, all right. Who was that? Atwater wrote that card?
Fitzwater.
Yeah, well, I knew it was some water. But what's your point?
When you're in a position where you have to prove that you care, that's exactly when it's too late to prove that you care. Don't care how many trips to Texas or Mississippi or, God forbid, Louisiana you make.
Hey, 41, who do you think you're talking to? An uncompassionate conservative? We got so much money going down to the Gulf Coast, Don Rumsfeld's starting to wish he was head of FEMA. And like that jingle says, nothing says loving like something from the Treasury.
See, this is where you seem to be forgetting your own best instincts, 43. You're never going to convince the Dems or the African Americans that you're a big care bear, but spending money like a drunken Ted Kennedy does happen to tick off your base some fierce.
Yes, sir. I know that. That particular fact is not flying under my radar screen.
No.
But see, that's why the little difficultations that Mr. DeLay and Mr. Frist are having at the moment might not be the worst thing in the world for your non-gubernatorial son.
Mm.
See, as my base scans the horizon, who else they got right now that, you know, A, isn't being investigated, and two, does have an opportunity to name another justice to the Supreme Court? In other words, you're looking at the big ball game and not the little game of rundown between second or third. I'm still the only game in town.
Yeah, I got a little caught up in your game imagery there, but
meantime, it's more than message we care, sir. Our message is that we can be responsive to the needs of storm victims at the same time that we can continue our good progress in Iraq. In other words, you know, show that we can eat and chew gum at the same time.
Sounds like it would kill the taste of the food and the gum.
Because if we don't, Carl thinks the political pressure to cut and run away from our good progress in the war on terror is just going to be tremendous and upward.
So you gotta chew gum if you want to continue to eat.
Yes, sir. In other words, this isn't message I care.
No, it's message we didn't listen to the Powell Doctrine, so please let us make a slightly less obviously messy withdrawal from Iraq.
I see. Colin doesn't really have a lot of relevance in this discussion these days.
Colin was a good man. He fell on his sword for you.
Yeah. And he's getting his reward where he should from the private sector. That's his plowshare right there. Speaking of which, see, that's the other reason my base is going to end up liking all this federal spending on the Gulf Coast.
Well, because making more poor folks down there into homeowners and business people going to mean more Republican voters there in years to come?
Yeah. Could happen. But in the meantime, look at all the fine pillows of the private sector sharing in those federal largesses. See, that's what we're really doing down there. Message, we're privatizing caring. So,
all right. Don't have to draw me a photo. Dad, I know what I'm doing. Butt your hiney out of here, right?
Well, you know how I hate to admit you're right, but...
you know, all it's going to take is for Carl to be indicted on the Valerie Plame thing, and then you're backing into 3 years where the team roster consists of lame ducks and dead ducks. Don't want to see that. Don't want to see that because... 43 message to you. I care.
Oh, I appreciate it, 41, but... you got the wrong game there. Think when the smoke clears, you're going to realize you're watching the Mighty Ducks. But tell Mom thanks for making your call.
Will do. You take care, 43.
Working hard on it.
I'm climbing the stairway leads from the kitchen in a bar in Tel Aviv. He asks for my age. He thinks I'm a virgin. That's why he asks for me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody's missing me. Somebody come get me. Of my mother, I send her what I can. She thinks I'm a waitress. She's proud I'm a waitress in the promised land. They promised me work and they promised me TV. They promised I'd never get bored. I'm back on the stairway, I'm higher than. Sophia, she's running and laughing out loud. Down by the river, in the middle of summer, I wish he'd get off of me now. Somebody's missing me, somebody's missing me, somebody come get me.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, time for...
Angela's Dog Trainer Corrections for You.
An article in the business section about an agreement between music company EMI Group and the band Korn identified EMI as the world's fourth largest music corporation. There are no international rankings available. based on objective data. The Motor Racing Column Friday said the Speedway motorcycle track in the Orange County Fairgrounds in Costa Mesa was a 90-yard oval. The track is a 190-yard oval. An article about President Bush saying the mistakes by his predecessors had emboldened terrorists referred to the U.S. warship Cole as a battleship. The Cole is a destroyer. An article in the travel section said the historic seaport in Mystic, Connecticut is on the north bank of the Mystic River. Seaport is on the river's east bank, which would suggest it doesn't even have a north bank, but I don't know about that. An article on Hurricane Rita reported that the acting director of FEMA acknowledged the traffic jams during Houston's evacuation were evidence of official failings. In fact, he said the Houston evacuation, while successful, had been difficult because the roads were not capable of handling the traffic. In the sports section last week, this Dayton sports misspelled the first name of Louise Suggs, winner of the 1949 Women's U.S. Open, as Lewis. Uh-oh. And a home section article about celebrities who sell homes to other celebrities said Ellen DeGeneres had bought a home owned by Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. She did not. Los Angeles Dog Trainer, corrections for you, ladies and gentlemen. And that is going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. She did not. Over the NPR worldwide throughout Europe, over the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. She did not. Up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ 7.415 megahertz on a new channel on Sirius Satellite Radio, channel 136, available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow, or on your computer, two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. All your friends are there, and it would be just like Ellen having bought that house if you'd agree to join me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, huh? The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. She did not.